Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do traumatized combat veterans need to regain their health when they return home, and why do so many fall through the cracks? Trial begins tomorrow for the Marine veteran accused of killing Navy SEAL Chris Kyle. Meanwhile, an average of 22 American veterans take their own lives every day. That figure includes some who never saw combat, but the suicide rate for veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars is disturbingly high, and it has called into question whether the Department of Veterans Affairs is providing these men and women with the care they were promised when they volunteered to serve their country. My guests want to see significant change in the way we serve veterans with mental illness. Jean Somers and Dr. Howard Somers are the parents of the late Daniel Somers, who died of suicide in June 2013 after suffering PTSD related to his service in the Iraq War. They're in town to speak tonight at the UTD Center for Brain Health as part of the lecture series, The Brain and Owner's Guide. Welcome both of you to Think.
Thanks, Chris.
I would love to start by talking about Daniel, not as a symbol, not as a statistic, but as a flesh and blood human being. Can you tell us a little bit about him, what he was like as a kid and a teenager and a young man?
You know, that's a very hard question for us to answer, not because it's hard to answer, but because it's hard to talk about. You know, we've been talking so much about Daniel is an adult and Daniel is a veteran, but to think about what we lost is very hard.
He was a really happy-go-lucky kid, smart as a whip, just could remember anything. He was very much a geek. He was really into Star Trek. I can remember driving him to and from preschool, and we would get in the car and he would say number one and he would direct me to where we were going, and I would pick him up from school and he would just pick right up where we left off. We had season ticket holder, we were season ticket holders to a football game, and the family would go, and I was not a huge sports fan and neither was Daniel would take a physics book and read during it.
Yeah, and he was what, 10 years old? Yeah, 11 years old?
And he didn't really, it dawned on him when he got into high school that, you know, he got picked on a lot. And he realized that the bus driver would always have on the local sports station in the morning on the bus ride to school. So he would listen, because nobody really talked to him because he was nerdy. And so he would listen. And so then he would get off the bus and he would be able to say, hey, how about this team? And you know, he would
That's a clever way to handle it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's just like, how did he figure that out to do that? But he was very much a problem solver, very much you know, we talk about this even later. He had such an incredible sense of justice, what right and wrong was and how you should treat people. And that really guided his whole life.
Never gave you any trouble?
Yeah, he did. He was, his mind was always going. And he got into things that he shouldn't have gotten into.
Like every teenager.
Well, yeah. The famous episode was he tested into, we were in the Phoenix area, of course. And that was one of the later issues, because when he came home, he went back to Phoenix and was involved with all the Phoenix VA stuff, which I'm sure we'll get into. But he was at a summer program at Arizona State, and he had taken the SATs when he was 14 or 15 years old and was only about 10 points short of testing into the ASU Honors Program at that age. So he's at this summer program, and all of a sudden we got a call from the campus police, I think, and somehow he had dropped something out of his
briefcase, backpack,
and it was like a bomb design. It's like, where did this come from? But his mind was just always thinking, always 10 steps ahead of everybody else. Like Gene said, going around in the car, it didn't matter what the music was that was on the radio. he would listen to it. He was into it. He could tell you pretty much any song, who sang it, who wrote it, what album it was in, and any genre of music. Growing up, he would just walk over to somebody. I mean, this little pipsqueak of a kid, and just start this conversation, and people would just be amazed at this little two-by-nothing and the way he was able to communicate and get his thoughts across.
What an amazing asset he must have been when he decided to join the Army National Guard. How did he bring that decision up to you? Because he sounds like someone who should have gone off and gotten his PhD right away, and that obviously was not his choice.
Right.
He had trouble when in regular school, he had trouble like getting his homework turned in and everything. So at the time, we lived in Arizona, and charter schools became a kind of a big thing. And we found a charter school that basically dealt in just basic education. You know, what are the requirements that you have to have in order to graduate high school? So we thought that this might be a good program for him, because the way that they did it is they basically took three classes at a time. And during the course of the school day, they had where the teacher would talk about the subject, then they would get in groups and do something, and then they would also be allotted time to actually do homework assignment, but all within the school day. So at the end of the school day, he had nothing to bring home. He didn't have to worry about it getting to the house and it getting back to school. So because of this program, he graduated actually a year earlier than a lot of his friends did from high school. And initially, he thought this was just great. He could get on with his life. But he had really a lot of trouble figuring out what he wanted to do. He was very much into computers at the time. He tried going to one of those colleges that are specific to information technology, the computer industry. But unfortunately, one of the first classes he got into was how to use a mouse. And it was a required class that he couldn't test out of. And there were two little old ladies in there who didn't understand that right-click meant this and left-click meant that. So he got very frustrated and he dropped out. He ended up becoming a certified auto mechanic because he was really interested in cars, and then decided, well, that wasn't really what he wanted to do. So he was a little bit lost in terms of where life was going to take him. And 9/11 happened, and it was a few years later that he finally decided he wanted to go into the service. When he first broached this up, and at the time he was like, Daniel was somewhat impatient. So when he said he wanted to do something, he like wanted to do it right then.
Right.
So he had talked to the recruiter, and the recruiter said, well, the way that he chose the Army, the way that it worked is that there were certain specialties and they came due at certain times. And the time that Daniel went in to talk to the gentleman, the next mission specialty that was coming up was bomb disposal. So Daniel's like, okay, I just want to get in.
Mm-hmm.
So he came home and he was talking to us about it. And I'm like, I have a little bit of problem with this.
Yeah.
Because this isn't really what he wanted to do. It was just the first thing that was available. And I said, what did you really want to do? And he said, well, I really want to go into intelligence. And I said, well, you know, how long would you have to wait? 6 weeks. I said, you can wait 6 weeks. Wait 6 weeks to do what you really want to do. It doesn't make sense to do it any other way. And so he did. And that's what he chose to do.
He actually had volunteered for the Army National Guard, not for the regular Army. So it wasn't that he had planned to go ahead and be in a potential combat situation. It was just that he was caught in what we refer to as the backdoor draft.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as you might remember, in 2003, we really weren't prepared to go to war in Iraq. And so they were using the National Guard as almost the primary source of manpower. And so at the time, National Guard was, their obligations overseas were even longer, almost twice as long as regular Army. And he was originally told he was going to be deployed for 15 months. As it turned out, it was about 13 months. But that's how he actually got involved in a combat situation.
So when you send a son to war, I would imagine that the thing that you worry most about is that he will be physically injured, that he will come home, unable to physically function the way he had before. Did something like a psychological injury, a psychiatric injury, was that even on your radar screens?
I really don't think so. And that's an interesting question because we haven't really talked about that. You're right. We actually had the opportunity to almost follow him on a weekly basis originally when he went over because he was sending us these amazing emails. As you can tell from the letter he left, he just had this ability to write and put his thoughts onto paper in an incredible fashion. So he would send these emails. But because he was in an intelligence unit, he very soon had the opportunity to get his hands on a cell phone. And this was an ArakNet cell phone. So one of the earlier people, as we understand it, to actually be able to communicate directly to home. So all of a sudden we lost the emails, which at the time was not a big deal, but now it would be great to have had this written history. But on the other hand, we were able to talk to him once or twice a week. And he would tell us, don't worry, I'm going out on a mission. I'll be gone for about 3 days and we'll be in touch when I get back. So, yes, our concern was the physical injury part of things. We knew at one point, and as it turned out, of course, later on, that he had dozens and dozens of blast exposures. We knew at one point that he was actually affected by an IED where he was the turret gunner on a Humvee. And when he first started, they didn't have any armor, and he didn't have a 50 caliber weapon. And that came later. In addition to which, we were so unprepared when this started that we, as his parents, supplied his body armor. And there was somebody in Florida who was a veteran who had made it his life's purpose to make sure that the service members going overseas were as well protected as they could be. So we actually contacted this gentleman through the internet, and I think it was within a day or two of contacting him, we had at our house this state-of-the-art, at the time, body armor with ceramic plates, which apparently work better than metal plates. And so that, if you see a picture of Daniel throughout his entire deployment, that was the body armor that he wore, which was what we bought for him.
I'm sure you were happy to do this to try to ensure his safety, but did it strike you as bizarre that you were furnishing this to him? And surely there were people in his unit whose parents didn't have the means to help in this way.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah. We're not a military family. You know, both of our fathers served. I had two brothers who served. But we never considered ourselves a military family. So the whole thing just seems so foreign to us. And, you know, you asked about psychological issues, and certainly now that would be on my radar. If anybody's child said that they were thinking of going, it would certainly be something that I would think of first. But, you know, the first thing you're thinking of is, I don't want my kid to get hurt. And so you think physically. And we were amazed, you know, first the body armor thing, and then when he told us that, you know, he was in this turret, and if he was protected maybe from the front, but not from behind or from the sides. And so he was a very had a lot of ingenuity. And so he, you know, rigged something up so that it would work for him and protect him until the service all caught up with him.
We're speaking this hour with Gene Somers and Dr. Howard Somers, parents of the late Daniel Somers, who died of suicide after suffering PTSD related to his service in the Iraq War. They're in town to speak tonight to the UTD Center for Brain Health as part of the lecture series, The Brain and Owner's Guide. You can find tickets at brainhealth.utdallas.edu. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Gene Somers and Dr. Howard Somers, parents of the late Daniel Somers, who died of suicide after suffering from PTSD related to his service in the Iraq War. They'll be speaking tonight at the UTD Center for Brain Health as part of the lecture series, The Brain and Owner's Guide. You can join our conversation by emailing think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. When Daniel came back after his deployment to Iraq, did he seem different to you right away?
Well, Daniel came back originally after his first deployment and did things a little bit differently than most people. Normally, if you go to language school, you go first, and that's your MOS, your specialty. Well, he must have impressed them so much that they gave him the opportunity to go to language school after his deployment. So he first came back and went to Monterey, California, to the Defense Language Institute, which is the largest language school in the world, tested into Arabic, or tested at the highest level, and so was given his actual, okay, what language do you want to take, Daniel, basically, and he chose Arabic. So the first time he came back, I really don't think that we noticed a major difference.
Maybe a little bit more nervous, a little bit more aware of his surroundings, wanting to make sure that if there was, I remember a specific time where he and his wife and the two of us and maybe even our other son were together, and we were walking down the street, and he was constantly looking around.
We were in San Diego. It was like the taste of, so this was like the taste of Mission Beach or something like that.
Or one of these kind of crowded events.
Well, yeah, you go to all the different restaurants. Right. And he was like a mother duck. You know, you have mm-hmm. to stay in line, and this is how you have to go and things like that. But thinking back on it, personality-wise, I really don't think there was that much of a difference after his first tour. But we have found out since then that he was at that time even expressing suicidal thoughts. Mm. And but I guess at the time, able to mask them better and control them better, and probably just not as seriously affected by his experiences as it became the second time.
So if I understand correctly from what I've read, and I realize these things get reported incorrectly a lot, but part of the reason he wanted to go back was he felt like he could maybe make amends for things that he felt weren't right in the first tour.
Right.
Not only make amends, but make things better. I mean, he just wasn't trying to fix what he had done, but he wanted to fix the whole situation. And this was Daniel. This young man had the biggest heart of anybody I've ever known. I mean, he literally had friends who didn't have shirts, and he would give them the shirt off his back, literally. So he wanted to go back and make a distinct difference. Now, after the DLI, when he graduated with honors in Arabic, he actually was able to go to work for L3, which is a large government contractor, sort of, we call it Halliburton Jr. Mm-hmm. And he was in D.C., and he was working as an intelligence analyst, and actually had an amazing amount of responsibility. He was in charge of the Levant, which was that whole Syria, Turkey, Middle East area. And according to him, he was briefing anybody with an organization that had a three-letter acronym. So that's what he was doing. But then the opportunity arose to go back to Iraq and basically do the same thing he was doing in D.C., but doing it the same job in the field.
Right.
And he assured us that he was at a secure part of a secure base, and it turned out he was in Mosul. Well, again, what we found out later was that he was actually going out on missions with the Joint Special Operations with JSOC, and made it his mission to save Iraqis who he felt were being unjustly accused of being terrorists for the most part. And at one point he said, all right, unless I get transferred to another area, I'm leaving, because he felt that one of the officers was just incredibly prejudiced and was accusing and jailing and who knows doing what else to what he felt were innocents. And one of this issue, the moral injury issue that we have become to believe very strongly in, that bothered him the most, that of everybody he was able to help, there was one man who he was convinced was innocent of what he was being accused of, and he couldn't get him freed.
So when he returned home from that second tour, did things then seem very different to you?
Very different, yeah. I mean, it much, much more hypervigilant. And I know it's a word that we hear a lot, but it's like just his eyes would just dart. He was looking around all the time. Couldn't really stand still, was doing a lot of the, you know, the hand.
Yeah,
something
kind of the nervous
to,
tapping.
Yeah, everything had to be moving.
Excuse me for interrupting you. As his mom, I mean, are you like sort of politely trying to pretend you don't notice this? Do you take him aside and say, sweetheart, what's going on?
Well, the problem was is that we were then living in California, and he was married, so he and his wife were living in Arizona. So while we the first time we saw him when he came back, we saw these things, but you know, you're thinking, okay, he's just back. He's just acclimating. And then time passes and you're still seeing it. And then, you know, you're kind of walking on shells thinking, you know, what can you say? What can you do? And sometimes when you would talk to him to try to discuss the things, his hands would just ball into fists and you're thinking, I'm hurting him. Mm-hmm. And so you don't want to hurt him. It was actually easier. It got to be a point where it was almost easier because I guess between the two of us, I'm the wordsmith. So Daniel and I would sometimes have these emails. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times I would sit down and I would write something like in a Word document to make sure that I had exactly tried to express exactly how I was feeling or what I wanted to say. And I would look at it for a couple of days to make sure that I wasn't going to be accusatory or whatever. And then I would email him the letter and then he would email me something back. But it was, mostly it was just that we didn't feel like we had any control, obviously, over him. He's over 18. He's married. You're hoping that they're trying to do some things. We did look into several different programs, but again, we're the parents, so they won't talk to us. And they say, well, he has to call or he has to initiate the discussion. And there was a program in the Boston area that I remember that was an inpatient program that had been getting a lot of press as being very, very effective if you went into it shortly after you came back. And so we told Daniel about it, and he said, okay. And then the next time we talked to him about it, he said, yeah, I called them, but they said I wasn't a candidate. Hmm. So then we're thinking, did he really call them? You know, you don't know. And do you want to then go into that? You know, like, did you really call them, honey? And it just got to be really horrible.
Well, there was so much more than just hypervigilance. I mean, he wouldn't wake up. He couldn't function. I mean, he was functioning fairly poorly anyway, but before afternoon, couldn't touch him. It got to the point where even he and his wife were doing air hugs.
And we didn't know this.
Yeah, so we would hug him. And that's the whole point of having a child, an adult child who is married, just is a huge issue that many families are having issues with and have to deal with, because it becomes a tremendous barrier between the parents and the child because of the issue of the child being married. You're separated on so many levels, and it's such an issue in the whole country that is something else that we feel needs to be addressed.
I want to talk about Daniel's experiences with the VA, which if I didn't know better, it would almost sound like there are roadblocks deliberately set up to keep hurting veterans from getting care. And I know it is not true that everyone who works at the VA doesn't care. So can you talk a little bit about what you knew in the moment, what you found out subsequent to his death about the way that he was accessing care?
Most of what we talk about now, I think I can fairly say we found out after his death. We knew that there were access issues early on. We knew that he had problems getting in to be seen. We knew that there were appointment issues, but we did not know the extent. You have to realize that this started back in 2008. Some things have improved. You also have to realize that he was in Phoenix, so that's not one of the better VA medical centers out there. Even to get in originally, he was caught in almost a catch-22 because from the National Guard standpoint, he was inactive ready reserve. So according to the VA, he wasn't yet completely a veteran, so they wouldn't see him. And what we have found out since then is that the default position should be you see the veteran, you see the person who comes in the door, and then you worry about eligibility afterwards. But that's not what happened. So then you go, he went to a DOD facility because the VA said, well, I'm not a veteran, but the DOD says, well, you're in active ready reserve, so you're not active, so we can't see you. So he was caught in that conundrum. The other issue is just getting in, just the availability issue. And the only way that he got in to a mental health appointment was because his mother, who is a psychiatrist, a mother-in-law. Mother's a psychiatrist too, but his mother-in-law, as all mothers are, but his mother-in-law is a psychiatrist, had a connection. She had actually, I think, been working a little bit, giving some volunteer time at the VA, and so she had some connections there, and somebody was able to actually pull some strings, so it's always who you know. Mm-hmm. And so he finally got in after 3 months. But then the problem at the Phoenix VA, which might still be in effect there, is that they had a postcard system for appointments. And so there was no guarantee, number one, that they would send the postcard. And then there was no guarantee that you received the postcard because there was no confirmation process as to whether or not they had a correct address.
I want to make sure people understand this. In this era where most things are done electronically or you get a phone call or, you know, my dentist calls me 3 days before to confirm an appointment.
Right.
This is you say I'd like an appointment. They say, OK, and we'll send you a postcard in a few weeks telling you when to show up.
Right.
Right. Right.
Right. And then they don't call to confirm the appointment. And then if you no-show for the appointment, they don't call to find out why you didn't come in. And their policy in writing
Back in 2008,
was that if it's a mental health appointment especially, you should call. You have to make up to three calls. And if you don't reach the person and if the person is perceived to be a danger to himself or others, you can send out the police to check on the person to make sure that he or she is okay. And we know that on Daniel's chart, it had already been noted that he had suicidal ideation. Hmm. The huge issue that...
I was just going to say that their computer systems that the VA works with are independent of one another. So the scheduling system is different than the appointment system, is different than the medical record or something. It's very convoluted, and they seem to really like their electronic medical record system. They think that's really good, but their other systems just don't interact with it. So even with on the benefit side, besides the hospital side, on the benefit side, that system doesn't speak to it. It's very convoluted, and it's really difficult to think to understand why they haven't done more to fix that piece of it, because fixing that piece of it could fix so much an individual veteran.
Right. And they're working on it, they say. But Daniel had problems not only with the VHA, the health administration side, but he also had problems with the benefits administration side. And then not only having his claim reviewed, but the fact that benefits and health don't talk to each other, so that he had a 40% or 30 to 40% disability through the VHA, but the VBA said, well, you've got 100%.
Well, it's the voc rehab. There's a piece of the benefit side of the VA that's called voc rehab. And I don't totally understand it, but my understanding is that there's the GI Bill, which you can go to school on, but then there's this other piece called voc rehab. And if you have a piece of education that you would like to do that falls under more a vocational, mm-hmm. as opposed to getting a Bachelor of Arts in something, that you could present them with a program that you would like to take. And Daniel at the time was really finding a lot of solace in music. So he thought maybe he would like to do something in music, become a music production, do music production. So he presented them with, this is what I would like to do. And apparently it's a three-man board, Invoke Rehab, and they reviewed his medical record, and they reviewed what he wanted to do, and they said, you can't do this. We're not going to give you money to do this. You're 100% disabled.
You're unemployable.
And therefore, you're unemployable. And on the one side, when he told us this, I got the feeling that on one side, he was devastated. But on the other side, it was like, oh, wow. This is as bad as it can get. I'm 100% disabled. I'm not just 40% disabled, you know? I'm having such difficulties, and I'm thinking, this is only 40%. Wow, what is somebody that's 100%? You know, you look at it from that standpoint. So there was some relief to know that he was. But then the benefits people, even though this is the same department of the VA, they don't talk, Voc Rehab doesn't talk to the actual disability part of it. So then he had to file an appeal through the disability part of it, saying that he was told by Voc Rehab that he was 100% disabled. It is so, I know.
It sounds like the work of Lewis Carroll. It would be funny if it weren't so life and death serious.
It is. Really.
And for someone who's dealing with a serious mental illness to also have to process this seems
impossible. Exactly. You hit it spot on. And we've spoken to the people in D.C. about this, and they're supposedly going to get back to us and see how they're going to fix this.
We'll talk in just a minute about the bill that was passed by the Senate last week and what that contains and what else you might like to see. And we will continue the conversation in a minute. My guests are Dr. Howard Somers and Jean Somers, parents of the late Daniel Somers, who died of suicide after suffering PTSD related to his service in the Iraq War. They'll be speaking tonight at the UTD Center for Brain Health as part of the lecture series, The Brain and Owner's Guide. You can find tickets online at brainhealth.utdallas.edu. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Jean Somers and Dr. Howard Somers, parents of the late Daniel Somers, who died after suffering PTSD related to his service in the Iraq War. They're here for UTD Center for Brain Health appearance tonight as part of the lecture series, The Brain and Owner's Guide. So as I mentioned before the break, the Senate voted last week 99-0 to expand suicide prevention programs, enhance mental health services at the VA. It seems quite clear that the bill will be signed into law. One question is, why has it taken this long? We have known for a number of years now that as veterans are returning from Iraq and Afghanistan, they have very serious problems that initially were not being addressed and in many places still are not being addressed in a timely and efficient manner.
Well, I think there it's so multifaceted. The one of the main problems that they're looking at now is just the transition itself, that each service has established a 3 to 5 day period of time that when you come home, you go through this, they just inundate you with all this information, either via the internet or talking and handing you pamphlets. And then there's this big barrel as you leave the room and it ends up being filled because these guys all think they're invisible, they've made it home, they don't need this, they're fine, and they don't really know until they physically get back home. And this really pertains more to Guard and Reserve than it does somebody who's part of our standing army, if you will, because they come back to bases, they have a built-in support network. But Garden Reserve is different. They're literally are in Iraq one day or Afghanistan, and within 3 days they're back in Dallas.
Yeah,
they're back in Mesa, Arizona, surrounded by people who have gone on with their daily lives and who just don't have a clue what these people have experienced. And I think it doesn't really sink in until then for the military person.
Well, I think the reason that it took so long to get something through Congress, it's just not an area that people either are aware of or want to be aware of, that we're having such a problem with our veteran population. Our IAVA has done a great job. Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America has done a great job in being the major proponent of this legislation. The Clay Hunt situation was a tragic situation. We're here with somebody who seemed to be doing well. I mean, he was connected with a lot of the veterans organizations. He was connected with IAVA. He was connected with Team Rubicon. He was out. He was helping in Haiti. He was helping disaster victims. And in spite of this, he committed suicide. But he, too, had problems at the VA. He had problems getting seen. He had problems hooking with a therapist. He had the same issues that Daniel did to a great extent. We are aware of efforts to make this problem more of a national issue, and we know that there have been efforts to propose articles, for example, in the New England Journal of Medicine with regards to teaching our non-military, non-VA mental health providers about this issue. And these articles have been rejected. The reason being given was, well, nobody really cares. There's not enough interest in this issue of educating our community mental health providers. So I think it was just the time plus the issues that came out in Phoenix. This was a perfect storm where all the whistleblowers came out of the woodwork about how difficult it was to get into the system, how the administrators were lying about appointment availability and things like that. And then you had the senator who introduced the legislation who was a veteran himself. Now, unfortunately, he got caught up in some other issues. This was Senator Walsh, who was appointed, and I don't remember what state. It was a north central state. It was either Minnesota or North Dakota, where he was appointed, and he submitted the legislation. So it was a series of coincidences or circumstances that made this the time to get this legislation, plus all the publicity of the 22 veterans a day committing suicide. The legislation, we feel, is a good first step. We feel that there are some very positive aspects to it. We feel, though, that there are many things that need to be added to it.
You would like to see the care of returning veterans with service-related injuries separated out from the care that is given generally to all medical conditions of veterans. Can you talk about why that would make a difference?
Well, I think when we look at Daniel, and that's basically our frame of reference, and it doesn't it's like we throw that out there as like, we need to rethink how the VA works. That's our point. It's not working. And so how can we get it to work? And so we look at Daniel and we say he had a problem getting access. Well, if they didn't have to be working on broken arms and dealing with prostate cancer, I mean, everybody in the community knows how to do these things. But what everybody in the community doesn't know how to do is how to deal with post-traumatic stress, traumatic brain injury, and something systemic like Gulf War syndrome, which is, you know, the whole body experience. Daniel could have benefited from being in a place where that's what they dealt with the whole system, and where there are team efforts. Now the VA, we know, is has started a lot of programs in a lot of the VAs where they are doing integrated care, which we are thrilled about. We think it is the way to go. We actually think the community could benefit from doing that for everybody. It would be so important for your doctors to really talk to one another on a regular basis, but particularly for somebody who has system problems and ones that not only are bodily but also mental. And so that's why we really feel that doing something like this could alleviate. We just don't feel that there really needs to be a whole separate set of doctors, basically two health systems, because now we're going to be competing for the best doctors mm-hmm. out there. And I want our veterans to have the best doctors out there. But should that preclude me from having the best doctor that I need to have? So
the statistic that shocked us, that a lot of people are unaware of, is that only 20% of our veterans are seen at the VA. That means 80% of veterans receive their care outside the VA system. We feel that you can increase that percentage dramatically, and especially for those who need the specialized care that the VA is expert at giving. And one of the things that they're expert at giving is doing is rehabilitation medicine also, is that if you would make the system into a center of excellence for war-related injuries, you could bring in so many more veterans who are out there and, as Gene said, don't have access into the system. They can get this coordinated care within the expert environments and from the people who really know how to deliver it. Now, there's tremendous amount of pushback to this idea, mostly from the VA and from, interestingly, the VSOs, the American Legion, Veterans of Foreign Wars, and even IAVA as we understand it. But that doesn't preclude us from still feeling that we would like to see some changes made in how the VA not only delivers its care, but to whom and the extent of the care that it delivers.
So just to clarify, if you were, say, a veteran and you're 62 and you have prostate cancer, pay for that veteran to receive care in a private facility or in a non-VA facility rather than taking up a VA bed? Am I correct?
All veterans are not eligible for the VA. Mm-hmm. You have to have some sort of disability percentage, and it even as we understand it, it can be a 0% somehow, but you can still have some sort of disability that makes you eligible for VA care. All veterans are eligible for a certain amount of time after they leave the service, and that's one of the things in this bill, that all veterans are going to be eligible for 5 years after they leave the service. But if you're a veteran who does have a disability who would otherwise be eligible for VA care, yes, if you had prostate cancer, you could be seen or would be seen on the outside. If you were walking across the road and got hit by a car and broke your leg, you wouldn't go to the VA, you'd go to your nearest medical center.
Daniel went to see you not long before he died. In retrospect, do you think he wanted to say goodbye?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no question in our minds at this point. This was Memorial Day of 2013, Memorial Weekend, and he and his wife drove out from Phoenix to the San Diego area where we live. We had a wonderful weekend, and according to his wife, he had not appeared that well for over 6 months, maybe longer than that. And subsequently, we had a great visit. We did. And he was walking. And as we know, he had tremendous Gulf War syndrome, and he had fibromyalgia, which made moving very difficult for him. But in spite of that, he kept up. He did everything. He ate. We hugged. But after they left, that was the last time we spoke to him. And we would call and we would text or we would email, and if he didn't get back to us immediately, we knew that within 24 hours we'd hear from him. And so a week goes by, and that's not unusual. But then when it became more than a week and we didn't hear from him, I said to Gene, there's a problem. And we had a trip planned back east to see my sister, who's on the East Coast. We took the trip, but the day we were coming back, we got a call at about 10 o'clock East Coast time that He had taken his life the night before. Yeah. There was 10 o'clock in the morning, and then he had taken his life the evening before. So as luck would have it, we had airplane reservations already to come home that day, and so it was a very tough flight home.
Was that something that at that point you had come to fear in any way?
I always say that it was a shock but not a surprise. I had nothing to hang my hat on, again, because he was married and because, as we have come to learn, so many married couples basically form a cocoon and feel like they have to protect those. They don't want you to feel embarrassed for them. They don't want you to feel that they're not living up to your expectations for them, that they just don't share the tremendous hurt, the tremendous pain that they're going through. They're embarrassed. There's that stigma, and they even feel that it extends to their immediate family, which, of course, it shouldn't. So, yeah, I was shocked but not surprised.
Yeah, I'd have to echo that.
Has your activism complicated your grieving process, affected your grieving process, helped your grieving process?
It is our grieving process. You know, I think within 3 or 4 days of Daniel's death, we were sitting in his living room with his wife and his mother-in-law. And I think it was his mother-in-law just opened up her laptop and started writing down the problems that Daniel had at the VA. And she wrote something and then verbalized it out loud. And then I said something and then his wife said something. And so we ended up coming up with this 19 pages of problems that Daniel had. And because she's a psychiatrist and his wife is a nurse and Howard's a doctor and I ran Howard's office, we felt that we came at this from a very unique perspective. Like if Daniel had had these problems in the community, how would the community have responded? What could they have done to make things different? So for every item, every roadblock that Daniel came upon, we said, this is how it would have been resolved if you didn't have to worry about being in the government. Hmm. You know, if it was my office, this is what I would have done differently with it. So that ended up being 19 pages. And once we came up with that, the four of us sat and talked about that these were going to be talking points. That if people asked us, this is what we were going to talk about. And Daniel's wife just obviously was not up to it at all, to be in the public eye. And so Howard and I said, we're going to do this. This is going to be our contribution.
Jean Somers and Dr. Howard Somers are the parents of the late Daniel Somers. They are in town to speak tonight at the UTD Center for Brain Health. You can find tickets at brainhealth.utdallas.edu. Thanks so much to both of you for being here.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Kristen Taylor. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.